Welcome back to another episode of Single Payer Radio. We broadcast our program from the historic Hayburn Building in downtown Louisville. The show is a project of Kentuckians for Single Payer Healthcare, and we are an affiliate of the Kentucky Chapter of Physicians for a National Health Program. We produce this program because we believe healthcare is a human right. We advocate for a national, not-for-profit, publicly funded, single-payer healthcare system for everyone. The views and opinions expressed on our show are those of the speakers and not the station. I'm Paul Hoppe, a volunteer with the group. Today, we've got Drs. Gene Shively and Mike Flynn with us, and we're going to discuss private equity in healthcare and some other issues. Mike?
Yeah, this is Michael Flynn, retired surgical oncologist from the University of Louisville. Let me begin with the usual disclaimer that my thoughts and comments that I make during this program represent my personal views and do not represent the views of the University of Louisville or the Department of Surgery.
I'm Dr. Eugene Shively from Campbellsville, Kentucky. I've been in a rural practice in surgery for over 40 years. And what I say does not reflect the opinion of Taylor Regional Hospital nor the Department of Surgery at the University of Louisville.
Now, before we talk about the program today, I would like to advise our listeners to double-check our comments. We're going to talk about a number of issues related to the healthcare industry in this country and what we believe is a solution to it. And again, I would challenge our listeners to double-check our comments. There are multiple sources, Google, Wikipedia. You can go to a library, ask a librarian to do a background check for you or whatever issue you're interested in. There's a book written by Gretchen Morgenson called These Are the Plunderers, which is a really interesting and informative review of the effect of private equity in healthcare in this country. Our program today is going to have two parts. We talked the last program last month about the impact of private equity on healthcare, which is not pretty. We're going to review some of those issues and some of the healthcare industry issues. And then we're going to make some recommendations about how to address this and what the solution is. So, Gene, I'm going to let you start off with whatever comments you'd like to make, and we'll continue the conversation.
Well, I'd first like to review the tremendous cost of healthcare in America. We spend approximately $3.8 trillion. In healthcare, that's the largest in the world. It's approximately twice as much as most first world countries. Obviously, it varies depending on what country you're talking about. And approximately a third of that money has nothing to do with healthcare. For example, profits. From for-profit hospitals, for-profit insurance companies, tremendous costs of drugs and huge profits, the huge amount of money that people are making from Medicare Advantage. There's a lot of hidden money, profit pharmacy benefit managers. It goes on and on and on. Another example is advertising. So I got interested in this whole subject because of the huge amount of money that's being wasted. Healthcare in America is the fourth largest economy in the world. The U.S. government, or the entire U.S. healthcare, The entire economy of America is number one, China's number two, California's number three. And if you set the healthcare industry in America, it's number four. Now, so how can we solve this problem with this huge amount of money being spent? And we're going to talk about that just a little later.
Gene, let me make a quick comment about that. And I think there's a fundamental question here, and we've talked about this before on this program. You know, sort of the rhetorical question is, what is healthcare? And the real question is healthcare a commodity, like the groceries you buy or the gas you put in your car or the socks or shoes or clothes, which was subject to exploitation by for-profit entities, or is this an essential public service and a government responsibility? And unfortunately, in this country, it is an industry which is vulnerable to profit seekers in almost every step along the way. Most other first world countries have some form of universal coverage that provides health care for all of their citizens. It's different in different countries. In the United Kingdom, it runs the entire system, the pharmacies, the hospitals, nursing homes, physician offices. Canada has a Medicare for All system that provides coverage, insurance coverage, for hospital and physician costs. It does not cover vision and hearing. So if you need coverage for that and you need to obtain it yourself, there are different ways of doing this in different countries. Most of the countries allow private insurance. If you want it, you have to pay for it. Some of those private insurance access in some countries are not for profit, and some of it is for profit. So there's a number of different ways other countries have dealt with this. So go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I wanted to get that. I think right. There's this fundamental issue that we're not dealing with in this country.
Well, I would like to just point out a fact that I think a lot of the younger people don't understand, the difference between a business and a profession. Now, that's changed radically since I graduated from medical school, and I've observed all this firsthand. But traditionally, medicine was a profession, and the concept of a profession was that, but in medicine at least, is that you took care of people regardless of their ability to pay, and your job was to take care of patients. That's opposed to a business, where a business is obviously to provide a service, but also to make money. And I've had personal experience with both of those. My father was in the jewelry business, and he had a jewelry business that was founded in 1910. And I grew up in that business, and we provided a tremendous amount of service to people, but we also was there to make money. We wouldn't sell them a diamond ring unless they could pay for it. On the other hand, it was a little different in practicing medicine. If it got called to the emergency room with someone who needed an operation, it was my job to operate on those people and take care of them regardless of their ability to pay. The concept, though, is that medicine has become a business, and it is growing at an exponential rate that most of us don't know about.
Now, we talked about this a lot in the last program. Now, in my recollection is correct, most of this change came in the 90s. Because in the late the 70s and 80s, the Blue Cross and Blue Shield was not for profit.
That's correct.
Now, the other for-profit health insurance companies were around, but they really had a very small, I guess, piece of the health care pie. But in the 90s, Blue Cross and Blue Shield became for-profit, and these other companies all began acquiring more and more of the healthcare population, and there was this slow transition from healthcare the way it was before to healthcare becoming a really big business, and today we function it with this multi-trillion-dollar healthcare industry.
And interesting that the two sentinel events that started all that started here in Louisville with the beginning of a for-profit nursing homes that evolved into a Humana, and then all the for-profits sprung off of that, and then there was a lawsuit here. The Louisville Bar Association sued a gentleman named Shapiro, who was a lawyer advertising around the benches around the courthouse, and in those days it was not considered ethical for a professional to advertise, and he took that case all the way to the Supreme Court, and now we have advertising among professionals. So we're off to medicine as a business, and it's expanding at an exponential rate. Now, that gradually grew over the 70s and 80s, and it kind of mushroomed in the 90s, and it's still growing at an exponential rate. And there's a new for-profit type business on the scene called equity companies. Now, equity companies I've never been in healthcare until just recently, and an equity company is a group of that gets investors, and they invest into a company. Traditionally, they've bought companies that were being sold by corporations that weren't doing too well. They've changed things around, and then they resold them, and they expect profits of 15 to 20%. This is good for business. A lot of big retirement plans invest in them. A lot of wealthy investors invest in them. And they've done quite well in the business world. But the problem is that they've now snuck into the healthcare business, and they're expecting large profits. And most people don't know that equity companies are involved in their healthcare. For example, 70% of nursing homes in the United States are now owned by equity companies. I just learned this about 2 years ago, that most of the nursing homes where I lived in South Central Kentucky are owned by nursing homes, but they don't ever tell anybody that. And the same thing with other types of medicine. For example, equity companies have now buying out physician practices. And they particularly like orthopedics, anesthesia, and they may be into dermatology. Urology is another popular one. And then the patient will frequently end up with bills that are higher than usual. For example, equity companies may buy a large practice, they add more on to that practice, and then they increase the billings and amount that they charge, and some of this is not paid for by the insurance companies, and so the patient ends up paying more.
Yeah, they do a number of things. The large For example, the emergency rooms will often, their strategy of the private equity companies is to, quote, improve efficiency, unquote. We talked about this a lot at our program last month. And in different places, that means different things, but it basically involves decreasing the cost of whatever practice they're running. So if it's an emergency room, the most cost involves the emergency room physicians, board qualified emergency room physicians. So in an emergency room that is run by a private equity company, they have fewer ER physicians, and then they hire physician assistants and nurse practitioners, which cost less. The consequence of that is a negative impact on patient care. The other issue about the private equity owning a physician practice or some facility is their goal is to manage that or run it, whichever term you'd like to use, for 4, 5, or 6 years, and then sell it for a profit and move on to something else. So these arrangements are not meant to be long, happy marriages. And when you think about a medical practice, I mean, if you start a medical practice, hopefully you'll be able to do it for 40 or 50 years.
Well, we need to ask ourselves, why are physicians getting involved in this, and why are so many physicians now working for someone else? They're either working for a large hospital system, either profit or not-for-profit, or an equity company. I think the answer to that is it's become extremely difficult to be in private practice on your own. You have all these issues with billing, with regulations, coding. You have to hire a huge number of people to work for you to do all those things. And it becomes extremely frustrating and time-consuming. You've got electronic medical records, and even if you're really good at electronic medical records, it takes up 2 or 3 hours of your day, which 30 years ago, it didn't take that much long to time to keep up with medical records. So let's say you've got a doctor or an orthopedic surgeon who's been practicing for 25 years, he's age 55 to 60, an equity company comes in that wants to buy their large practice, and they give them a lot of money, and so they take away the administrative problems, they buy the building, the owners of that practice get a lot of money, they get to practice without having to deal with the financial part of the practice, and they're happy. And so they sell out. And this is happening really, really a lot. I know of a practice in South Central Kentucky where a very, very, very strong practice had been there for probably 60 years. And finally, the son of the gentleman who started the practice finally sold out. And I'm sure it was because of all these frustrations.
Now, in my introduction, I mentioned an author named Gretchen Morgenson, who's written a book called These Are the Plunderers. Now, I listened to a podcast in which she discussed a lot of these issues, and the question came up as why would a physician sell out to a private equity company, and you're exactly right. That's what she said, and I would encourage our listeners to find the podcast of Gretchen Morgenson, author of These Are the Plunderers, because they talked about this issue, and while that physician who initiated the buyout, one of the issues that individual didn't recognize that what's going to happen to that practice some years down the road. And then that, that what the issue is that this is not a long-term arrangement, that the private equity company is going to make changes where they can make more money. They'll do upcoding. They encourage the staff members to do that. They encourage the physicians to do more services that bring in more money. For example, in a dermatology practice, they would recommend more Botox, more biopsies, more surgical procedures, anything that will generate more money. And then at the end of the day, they sell out and they're gone.
Do you want to get over to...
Well to let me do just one more thing here. Let me just kind of... Let's do a quick review of the issues related to the healthcare industry quickly, and then talk about the solution.
Okay.
And so let me quickly run through this, and then we can move on from private equity and the healthcare industry to how we can change this. I just want to run for you a list of issues that have made healthcare in this country so complicated and so expensive. You've got over 900 for-profit health insurance companies, each with 15 to 30 plans. And the issues that they have created that allow them to make money make this healthcare system incredibly expensive and complicated and confusion. So you have pre-authorization. They have to authorize whatever healthcare activity, whether you need to have a colonoscopy or a biopsy or having your hernia fixed. Their co-payments, their deductibles. You could have a plan that has a very low deductible that is more expensive, or a plan that has a very high deductible that's relatively not expensive. But then if you get into a situation where you have some serious healthcare problems, you end up getting a huge bill. Their coverage denials, the information on the healthcare that contract that you have with the country company is got pages, and most people don't read all those pages to find out what they're not being covered for.
And if you do read them, you don't understand them. They're all very, very confusing.
And that's intentional. There's no question about it. There's surprise billing. We talked about the private equity-owned insurance emergency rooms. Well, the people, often these are often out of network. So when someone comes to an emergency room, they're taken by an ambulance. You know, they're in a vulnerable situation. They've got cardiac pain, or you know, or they've done something and dropped a something on the foot, and the foot's swollen. They think have some broken bones. They want to be taken care of, and not going to go in there and try to find out whether the people in the emergency room are in the network or not in the network, or whether they're being covered. They just want to be taken care of. And if they're not in the network, they end up with a big surprise bill. There are a lot of out-of-pocket costs and uncovered services, and all of this stuff is just the insane complexity of the current system that involves all these for-profit insurance companies. And then we have Medicare Advantage, ACO REACH, and value-based care, which are situations in which these same insurance companies have been allowed to get into various aspects of Medicare. We have an unregulated pharmaceutical industry, essentially. Up until recently, Medicare was prevented from negotiating with the pharmaceutical industry for the cost of drugs. which is an absolutely insane economic situation. We have all kinds of middlemen, like the pharmacy benefit managers. We have 100 million people in this country with medical debt. Medical debt is the most frequent reason why people file for bankruptcy in this country. And as you mentioned earlier, Gene, one-third of the revenue in U.S. healthcare is not spent on healthcare. So having finished that, what do we do about it?
Well, there are several options, and some of these options can be combined, and some of the issues are obviously political. One of the first options, it would be to go to a single-payer system, like in Britain, where the government runs the entire program, and it's financed with federal money and taxpayers. Another option is some Medicare for All, where you could take the existing Medicare program and extend it. You could extend it down to like to age 55. You could extend Medicaid. Actually, California has extended Medicaid. California is close to taking care of all the people. They haven't reached it yet, but they're getting close. Another option that we could do, like as in Australia, is called the public option, where you would have a private healthcare system, which is run predominantly a private healthcare system where you can buy private insurance, or you can go with the government insurance. You would have to pay into both, but if, for example, in Australia, you can have private insurance, and then you can have public insurance. The advantage of having the private insurance is that it's kind of like in Europe, where you can jump the line. You know, if you have the private insurance, you get in to see the doctor quicker. You may get in Europe, most countries you can get private insurance where you see the physician and go to a private hospital. About a third of the people in Australia have the private insurance. The rest have the public insurance. Now, we need to do some other things in America, which is extremely important, and that is implementing some control on the health care, such as negotiating drug costs. Part D of the Medicare law states that we cannot negotiate. Medicare cannot negotiate with the drug industry. The VA's allowed to do that. Medicaid's not allowed to do that. But Medicare is not allowed to do it. If we could do that, we could save a huge amount of money in the pharmaceutical industry. We need to regulate standard billing practices and administrative overhead. For example, if you're a doctor and you're dealing with 10 different insurances, each insurance company's got a different form to fill out. They will allow certain procedures and not allow other procedures. You got to get pre-authorization, and it's different for different insurance companies. If we could standardize some of those forms and some of that way, administrative charges, then we could dramatically decrease the administrative costs.
Wouldn't Medicare for All do that?
Yes, okay. We could put that into the change it into the law so that we would have standardized forms and what's required to be pre-authorized and what's not, and it would be standardized. And each insurance that you have to fill out for a bill would be standardized rather than 10 pages long and very confusing and different from the next insurance company.
Let me do this. Let me raise four questions that we should address about Medicare for All. And then I want to review with the opposition to Medicare for All, and then go back to these questions, because some of the answers to some of the questions is going to be in the opposition. So question number one, who's covered? Question number, I'm going to answer them now. I just want to raise them so they're out there, and then go through this other, and then we can come back to that. So we've got who is covered, what is covered, this is Medicare for All, the funding, and then I think what we need to talk about is the political reality of whatever you end up with, because the Affordable Care Act was changed. Original Medicare was limited in its ability, as you just mentioned, to negotiate bills with the pharmaceutical industry. And the political reality was that in order to get that passed initially, in the very beginning, they had to negotiate that away. So those are the four questions. So let me go through a list of the usual, of the opposition to Medicare for All. So that's the usual suspects. That's going to be the pharmaceutical industry, for-profit health insurance companies, the private equity firms, pharmacy benefit managers, all of the middlemen that are between the physician and the patient. These are not people who provide health care. They're all bean counters, bureaucrats, and administrators who are regulating, playing with the money. So the second issue, and I've heard a number of politicians, one of which we were talking about not long ago, before we started the program, was socialism. Medicare for All is not a form of socialism. It is simply a government-run, non-profit health insurance option that exists in most other first-world developed nations. Now, the circumstances of it come back to those four questions that we talked about before. Another opposition was the death panels, which is complete BS. The other opposition was that there's no choice, that you will lose your access to your physician. And actually, just the opposite is true. There's more choice, there would be more choice and more portability in a Medicare for All system than there is with the Medicare Advantage, ACO REACH, and the value-based care, and all of the for-profit insurance company plans. As you mentioned earlier, they all have networks, prior authorization, limited coverage, no portability. They tend to cherry-pick the healthy patients to keep them in their programs and lemon-drop the patients with multiple comorbidities because they cost too much to take care of, and they can't make as much money if they have these unhealthy patients who are often the ones that need health care the most. So the out-of-pocket costs to patients increase. Now, lastly, the issue of funding is they claim that this will cause massive tax increases. First of all, this is not true. Secondly, this is a complex issue because there are multiple funding options that range from a progressive personal income tax to a progressive estate tax, taxing offshore held profits, essentially creating a situation where the corporations, the rich and the ultra-rich, pay a fair share of their taxes. Now, Warren Buffett, one of the richest men in the world, pays less tax than his secretary, and it's not unreasonable to expect these people to pay a fair share, because if they were functioning in the Central African Republic or Haiti, which is a country which is almost it's become dysfunctional, they wouldn't be rich. So having said that, let's go back to these questions. Who's covered?
I think everyone has to be covered.
Yes, yes. So the Medicare for All, the way it would be visualized, would cover everyone under 65. So that's who would be covered. Expanded services.
I think all reasonable services would be covered.
So
obviously, you know, you can't cover cosmesis for everyone. You can't, somebody comes in and demands an unnecessary procedure you shouldn't cover. But it has to be reasonable medicine that's covered.
Right. So the Canadian Medicare for All covers hospital and doctor services. The way one option, and again, the last question is the political reality. One option of Medicare for All would be to cover hospital doctor services, as the Canadian program does, preventive services, long-term care, reproductive, dental, vision, prescription drug, and medical supply costs. Now, these are all basically medically necessary services. Now, what would get negotiated away, like the Medicare inability to negotiate with the pharmaceutical industry, is these are the realities that I think we need to talk about.
There are a lot of things that could be eliminated, like, for example, pharmacy benefit managers.
Yes.
What
do they do?
Well, they make a lot of money.
Yes, they do. They make hospital pharmacies. They live in a mysterious world between the drug manufacturer, the drug distribution, the pharmacy, and the client, the physician, and the patients, and they make up drug formularies, and they figured out way to make money every step along the way, and it's not clear. There's really no transparency about exactly how they're making all their money.
No, it's not. I've tried to figure that out, but I haven't been able to find that, at least online. I think you'd have to be involved with the companies and it'd probably take you several years to figure out what's exactly going on. And you may be, like most companies, they have different areas that are siloed off, and you may never find out the real truth about some of those companies, so why they're doing it and how they're doing it.
Well, if you had a Medicare for All, government-run, nonprofit health insurance company that covered everyone in this country under 65, you have huge negotiating leverage to deal with the pharmaceutical industry. That's where probably much of the cost of healthcare to the U.S. citizen is inflicted, and the out-of-pocket cost is to the pharmaceutical industry, which is just unregulated and gets away with charging literally whatever they want. But if this option or this aspect or if this was the way Medicare for All was designed politically, it would allow huge ability to regulate and negotiate the cost of all of those things, and the other issue would be that all of the administrative complexity of the 900 for-profit health insurance companies, who could still exist. There's no indication that if a Medicare for All nonprofit government-run health insurance company were established in this country, they wouldn't be passing laws that say you couldn't have health insurance companies. They'd still be here. But the impact would be much less than it is today.
And it doesn't have to be government run. It could just be government regulated like it is in Germany. Oh, yeah. And their health care is about half of what ours is, their cost. For they regulate health care. One of the other things you can do in the commercial industry is, for example, in Germany, I think it's around 7% of the money they make goes to health care. Half of it's paid by the employer, half of it's paid by the employee, and then they can go out and select different insurances from not-for-profit insurance companies, and then they're fully covered. So you have a private industry there but it's not gouging huge profits from the system, and it seems to work fairly well in almost all European countries. Now, they're not all the same; they're all different. They go all the way from like what's in Germany and Switzerland, all the way to what's in England. The English system is a socialized system, but you need to remember that the Brits really like their health care. You remember how all that got started. It was just at the end of World War II, and Churchill got voted out of office based on that one issue.
It was Anurin Bevin who established that. The way it, and again, I don't know how it's going to work out. And I mean, if you look at the other first world countries, they have an assortment of other ways to do it. South Korea, for example, in 1989 established a universal national health insurance. It's compulsory. It was funded by a combination of a government employer, employee surcharge, and a tax on tobacco. They've all figured out different ways to. But the bottom line of all of this is that there is some form of government-run coverage, or as you say in Germany, government-regulated coverage, allowing the insurance companies, whether they're for-profit or not-for-profit, but they're not left to their own devices. It's all controlled and regulated. One of the other side of the coin, again, in the cost containment issue, is we've had Ted Young on the show on a number of occasions, who's a surgeon from Hamilton, Ontario. And he's at McMaster University, and his clinical practice is relatively simple. When I was in clinical practice at the University of Louisville, we had people who in the office who did the billing, they did the pre-authorization. We have a large number of staff that is hired to deal with all of those issues we both mentioned earlier. Ted Young when we had him on, we asked him about how he manages their practice. It's very simple. In Canada, they send their bill to one payer, the Canadian, the provincial government, which is funded by the central government, and they get a check within 2 or 3 weeks. He has a secretary and his wife working in the office, and that's it. I mean, we had 40 or 50 people dealing with all of these issues. And so that the administrative cost of all of these hoops and steps that you have to go through, I don't necessarily goes away, but certainly becomes less of an issue compared to the way it is today.
Now we need to, are we going to discuss the political reality?
Well, yeah, well, that's the issue, because I don't know how this could come about, be honest with you, with the political divides that exist in this country today, anytime soon. Having said that, there's more and more recognition, I think, of the difficulties and the unacceptability of the current healthcare system. One quick example, and I'll pass it back to you. The Surgeon General in the Trump administration, I'm sure you've read about this in the paper, recently went to an emergency room somewhere for dehydration, ended up with a $5,000 bill. And he's been very, and again, he was on the other side of the blanket from us when he worked in the Trump administration, and apparently has recognized that this issue is just not sustainable. And the other example of that is your relative Don Henderson, who's been on here, who is a doctor of health administration, and he has told us on a number of occasions, he's been on the program 2 or 3 times, that this current system is not sustainable.
Well, I'll make a prediction. I think eventually, and I don't know what eventually means, several years, we're going to see a more of a collision that's going on right now. For example, the problem with Baptist Health and Humana and Baptist not taking their Advantage patients. The same thing is happening all across the country. The providers cannot sustain their services based on decreased revenue. The same thing's going on in home health. There are a lot of home health services that won't take Medicare Advantage plans. The problem is that Medicare Advantage patients, who most of which are retired people, for example, in the state of Kentucky, if you're a retired school teacher, you're automatically signed up with a Medicare Advantage plan. I think there's going to become a collision with all these problems, and eventually the politicians will be forced to do something in order to solve the problem.
Well, I agree with you. I don't know how far down the road it's going to go, but it's just getting worse and worse, and all the issues we talked about with private equity in healthcare made it far worse.
Yeah, I don't think the private equity should be allowed in healthcare. No. I'm all for private equity if they want to deal with real estate or the market or any, but healthcare is not where for-profit should be.
Well, there's a fundamental conflict of interest between the profit seeking and providing good health care.
Right.
And that's we've talked about this the last program we did about private, and we've talked about it just recently with all the bankruptcy and medical debt that exists in this country that really is not an issue in other countries. I wrote a paper about this in Louisville Medicine a year or so ago, and I researched the issue of medical debt and bankruptcy in other first world countries. And I really couldn't find very much, because there's not very much about it, because it doesn't happen very often. In France, a country of 70 million people, I think, and change, 2017 or 2018, I can't remember exactly which, there was one medical bankruptcy. One. In this country, we have anywhere from 200 to 800,000 medical bankruptcies, depending upon, you know, whatever's going on in that year, and it represents the number one reason that people file for bankruptcy in this country. So, we'll see what happens. I am hopeful that with the election coming this year, there will be a change in the power structure in Congress, and I don't know if that'll happen or not. And if it does, it'll start moving us in the right direction for some of these issues.
Well, now, I would like to end on this. Some of these situations, like Medicare Advantage, the REACH program, value-based health care, have stimulated from the federal government with CMS. They started these programs, and they set up the situation for for-profits to make more money off of them.
Well, that's the issue, the political reality, because
right.
that's the negotiating issues that had to be accepted in order to get these things passed.
Right.
I mean, the Affordable Care Act made concessions for political representatives of the for-profit insurance companies and the pharmaceutical industry. So it's a hard call. I just hope that the discussions that we have on this program are being listened to by people, and I hope that our listeners, instead of accepting what we're saying as gospel, they challenge everything that we say. Go to whatever reference source they find reliable, and double check our facts. I think we're about done here. You have anything you want to say as a final comment before we let Paul
take us
out of here?
I think we've covered it fairly well.
Well, I think so too, you guys did a great job today of explaining this, and like Mike said, I hope people are listening and take it to heart, because it's a very serious problem facing us today. One thing I wanted to say is the Canadian system. You hear people say that they heard this and they heard that, and it's not what it's cracked up to be, but I disagree with that. I've talked to lots of people in Canada about their healthcare system, and by and large, they're pretty happy about it.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I've done. Every time I'm on a trip or I run into somebody from Canada, I ask them how they feel about it, and most of them are fairly happy with it. I was on a cruise in St. Lawrence Seaway last fall, and I ask a lot of Canadians, and they're fairly happy with their system. I mean, they have problems. All healthcare systems have problems, but they are generally fairly happy.
Yeah, I agree, and I've had the same conversation with a number of surgeons. These were people that I worked with in organization called the Society of Head and Neck Surgeons, which actually doesn't exist anymore. It became the American Society for Head and Neck Surgery when the sort of general surgical group and the otolaryngology group combined. But these were people from McGill and in Montreal, McMaster's University out in Western Canada, and generally they're very comfortable with the system. It's not complicated. You don't have to deal with over 900 for-profit insurance companies. The reimbursement was reasonable, and the clinical practice was very easy and very simple. So I guess we're done. I want to ask all our listeners to again think about double checking our facts and our references, and please think about the issue of the political reality of doing something about the way healthcare is delivered in this country.
Oh, another thing on the Canadian system that I wanted to bring up is that it's different in each of the provinces. So some of the stories that you may hear may be related to that particular province that person lived in. So not everyone is as happy as they could be, I guess. And I also want to make clear that when people are comparing our system to other systems, such as the multiple systems that are in Europe and Canada, that no, nobody says their healthcare system is perfect. Everybody complains about it.
Yes, you're absolutely right about that.
I've talked to people all over Europe about their healthcare system, and they all have their complaints, but they all seem to know how bad our system is. So I guess, yeah, we are getting close to the time limit. I did want to bring up that Forward Radio, which is host us and the other public service programs on the air, are going to have their spring fund drive starting soon. And it's a great time to subscribe or send a donation in, because we're ran completely on donations and funded by... We have some sponsors that are that help us out. I'm not sure if I'm supposed to use the term sponsor. I think there's another name for it. But so anyhow, I'm glad that you joined us this time for this program, and keep tuning in, because we're going to be here until we get what we want, and that's universal health care for everybody.